Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
What's going on, brother?
What's up, Dan? How you doing?
Los Dito, what's going on?
Hey.
What's up? Glad to be back, man.
Absolutely.
What's up, Dan? What do you got?
It looks like Donald Trump is back to his acts of theater, and I think the American people are getting to see a glimpse of what he's going to be doing for about the next 90 days. Putting through this, did you catch the, I don't know what you call it, a memo, or was it just a tweet? What exactly is this thing that he put through?
It's often just a tweet, but that's a great point. But yeah, these were, he kind of called them executive orders, but only one of them was an executive order. Three of them are memoranda. And he basically tried to step in and do what Congress was unable to do. Congress was trying to sit down and iron out an extension of the additional unemployment benefits, try to extend the eviction moratorium that was passed early on in the pandemic. And basically Trump sat down and tried to do all that with the stroke of a pen. Shows pretty much, again, his lack of understanding of the Constitution. But Dan, you had some reactions to that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think his move here is to be like, oh no, the American people think that nothing is being done about this, but trust me, something is being done about this. But then when you pull back the curtain, there's just like an orange dude sitting back there laughing, you know, like, cause there's not actually like, there's no wizard.
The Wizard of Bronze.
So, like, this payroll tax thing that he's been obsessed with for, it seems like, almost since March, he's cutting, but he's not actually cutting. He's deferring it. So when your regular taxes are due in April of 2021, which I'm assuming most people will really need that money or they'll be looking to pay as little as possible, that payroll tax is going to come due. And that doesn't do anything for the 20 million Americans who are out of work right now.
Right. A payroll tax is only helpful to people who are still in their jobs, which is really not the global problem we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I think you have to be on the payroll for it to be a tax.
That's right. Payroll.
Then there's the $400 of unemployment benefits, but it has the strings attached to it that the state has to pay $100, and does he even have the authority to offer up $400 a week? I mean, does he have budgetary or appropriation authority?
He found a chunk of money that he can kind of do that with, but no, that is definitely congressional responsibility, is to decide what to do with the federal budget. So, yeah, that'll be challenged in court. And then we'll have governors who don't want to pay the $100 piece of it that they are designed to pay under the way it's written now.
Now, I heard a rumor that he was planning on using Eric's college fund. And Eric got really mad because he's excited to sleep in the dorms. But, again, that's probably going to be challenged in court, right?
Yeah.
Because Trumps like to sue Trumps. And then I think the most troubling after our last episode on eviction is this this moratorium, which only applies, it's almost like a recommendation to federally owned housing, basically, I assume Section 8 and subsidized housing, but that's only like a quarter of the rental market.
Well, yeah, so it does apply to those, but it specifically applies to any tenants who rent from houses or apartments that are owned through a federally backed mortgage. So that's about a quarter of renters in the country will experience a moratorium, a shutdown on any eviction proceedings that could come their way. It also suggests to HHS and HUD that they look into other ways to kind of extend this moratorium, but it is a very weak order in terms of how many people will protect from facing homelessness during.
Right, and also a moratorium doesn't say anything about canceling the debt. It's just like pushing a pile of debt into a big pile, and then, you know, the next thing you're gonna have is a wave of bankruptcies, right? Mm-hmm. Because people who couldn't pay $1,000 in, you know, July are gonna have a pretty hard time paying $5,000 in November.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Once people do get back on their feet, they're having all that back rent is gonna be a huge barrier for a lot of people.
Somebody's getting fired. Somebody's definitely losing their job over this.
Right. Trump's basically reacting to whatever's on Fox and Friends that morning. So, like, that's where his mindset's coming from.
Yeah, from the nosebleed seats, it's definitely one of those, you know, hey, look, Congress can't do what they're supposed to do, so I'm going to step in because I'm the strong guy. So his base just eats that up. That's pretty much what it seems like to me.
Right. That is the concerning thing, is that his base will see this as, like, you know, Trump's finally doing what Congress couldn't do. And what we pay Congress to do. That's a great reaction.
The other thing, I don't know if you guys caught this, but Trump low-key just said that he wants to defund Social Security because I had no idea until I looked it up. The annual payroll contributions to Social Security, basically $1 trillion. And then there's some interest with, like, Social Security benefits that accrues and some other small taxes, but basically $1 trillion. And he's saying if he's reelected, he will eliminate the payroll tax, which then would accelerate the Social Security Trust Fund is supposed to run out in 2034 or 2035, which sounds far off. But how many years without that $1 trillion would it take to run out? I mean, probably 4 or 5. Right. I mean, so
whenever we hear Republicans talk about defunding Social Security or restructuring Social Security, the next line that comes out of their mouth is privatizing Social Security. So what ends up happening there, if they ever were successful in that effort, is that they would go ahead and pass off those contracts to their financial backers. And so you'd have these hedge funds who would pick up and run with this, basically setting up private 401ks for every American, as opposed to the Social Security that we know today.
I've been hearing that we were going to lose Social Security now since I was like, what, 5, 6?
Right. And it hasn't happened. And it is one of the most popular programs when you pull Americans nationwide. So,
well, it's like Trump has lost... A long time ago, he lost people of color. He's losing more and more women. And so his group is old white dudes. And he's like, hey, old white dudes, I'm going to take away the thing that pays for your health care during a pandemic. And you're like, I mean, Social Security checks are like $1,000 a month, right? They're not, this is not a lot of money for most people. I don't understand his strategy if he has one, because this is like his base are old people.
So our old friend Bernie was in the news recently with a new bill that he is proposing called
Burn It Down,
called the Burn It Down Act. No, called the Make Billionaires Pay Act. And basically what Bernie is trying to do is highlight the fact that a handful of billionaires have made obscene amounts of money during the pandemic, at a time when people are really cash-strapped, facing homelessness, facing evictions, and job loss, you know, all of that. And so this act would basically be a one-time tax on those handful of billionaires who have cleaned up during the pandemic, and tax about 60% of that money made during the pandemic, and use that money to pay for Medicare for the year and to pay for Americans' out-of-pocket healthcare expenses for the year. I don't think it's a super serious act in terms of thinking that it would get passed, but I think it's a really important way to highlight for Americans just how much the inequities have grown and that wealth disparity has grown during the pandemic as opposed to, you know, everybody suffering alongside everybody else. Lois, you've done some reading on this. You have some thoughts on this. You want to go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bill, it really does sound good in principle, and it definitely sort of satisfies, you know, those urges, right, by a lot of Americans to get what they're, you know, what they're due, what they're owed, right? But some of the math behind how these, you know, start dates and the end date for the bill are what essentially they're going to be those large threads that the senators are going to be wanting to pull in, you know, if and when the bill makes it to committee. And I just wanted to kind of highlight those just to kind of, you know, to give the listeners a better idea as to, you know, what are the issues with it and you know, where it kind of, you know, may stall and why it might stall. So essentially, the net worth of billionaires who would pay this tax is based in large part on their market holdings, right? And if you look at the S&P and the Dow, the markets began tumbling well in advance of the mid-March shutdown, which is when, you know, this bill effectively starts the clock on when, you know, the tax is going to be imposed. And so the issue with that is that, you know, yes, the market has, you know, the market bottomed out, you know, right around the, you know, the end of March, and then it recovered, right? You know, and if you project all the way out to today, it's back to where it was at the beginning of the year. So what that means is that most of that growth, that and the money that the billionaires made in the market, if they've realized any of those profits, are really just the markets recovering, right? And those billionaires recouping their losses during the February market crash. And so, you know, some critics are going to say, and we'll say that a fair way to measure the effect of this, of the coronavirus on the wealth of billionaires would be to start the clock a little earlier, right? Back to when their wealth started to be impacted for, you know, for better or for worse. And that would be back in February. And so, yeah, it's one of those things that I agree with you, Pat. It's definitely more of a message, sending a message, right, on the part of Sanders, and not just Sanders. It's, you know, the bill is also co-authored by Kirsten Gillibrand and Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts as well.
Right. No, and I think you're absolutely right about, like, you know, getting into the weeds about how to kind of mark where it starts, and all that is correct. But I think it's more of a conversation starter and highlighting for people the fact that, you know, a company like Amazon makes, you know, billions,
hand over fist,
obscene amounts of money and doesn't pay their fair share of taxes. And I think if we look at American history, you look at times like coming out of World War II, the top marginal tax rate was in, you know, the upper 90% for the highest earners. And it was seen as patriotic. It was seen as someone's duty to pay what they, you know, that massive chunk of their earnings in order to help rebuild the nation. And I could, you know, I think you can argue that we're in a similar crisis now, and that, you know, if you took the old way of looking at it, it would be the patriotic thing to do for those top earners to pay into the system and try to rebuild, and, you know, and find some type of solution that'll help us get out of this pandemic stronger and hopefully more equal than the way we went into it. You know, I think Elon Musk, who used to be a darling of the left because of the fact that, you know, a lot of the technology that his company's developing is, you know, helping us look towards a greener future, has really been stepping in it lately in terms of the way the left views him. He went right at Sanders with kind of a tired meme about, you know, it was something about the Sanders drinking game every time he talks about using other people's money to pay for free government programs,
right,
to take a drink. Well, you know,
you drink someone else's
beer. Right. You drink that. That's correct. You drink someone else's beer. But I just think that's a pretty childish way of looking at it. And instead of him, you know, and I think we've seen Elon Musk get into it in pretty childish ways, you know, ego driven back and forths with people. But I do think that Musk is kind of trying to to vilify politicians like Bernie for pretty self-serving reasons. And I think he's missing the fact that a lot of his support, his public support, has historically come from environmentalists and people on the left who hope for a greener future.
And you mentioned the sentiment back in, you know, the wartime, right? World War II. And it was even the rich and the wealthy in the country felt it was their patriotic duty. Elon Musk is a South African national. I mean, he really doesn't have any real sort of, I mean, I can't say that he or does or doesn't have, but looking at it through this lens, you know, it's hard to kind of, you know, make a case for him having that super patriotic, you know, feeling and duty to the, you know, to the country.
Right. But he's not making billions off of, South Africa. He's making billions off the United
Absolutely.
States.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right. And Bernie pointed out that he's taken, you know, billions of dollars in government subsidies. He's taken, you know, government tax cuts in order to build that wealth that he's built here. And that's, you know, that was the clapback from Sanders. And that's absolutely right.
Yep. Is that the first time clapback has ever been used on the Trickle Down Socialism podcast? I'm totally
that
here for it.
Is the first time we've used it.
By the way, clapback was actually a toy that Bernie used to play with when he was a kid. It was called the clap. It was just two pieces of wood with a
spring on it.
Yeah, he was like, "Oh, that's how I learned." Right. So, Pat, you're really inspiring me to want to read more about Bernie. I wish there was a way to, like, I don't know, read up more about Bernie Sanders.
It's funny you should mention that because our interview this week. I sat down and talked to Chuck Rocha, who was a senior advisor for the Bernie Sanders campaign and led historically the most effective Latino outreach program in the history of U.S. politics, winning, you know, outlandish percentages of the Latino vote in Democratic primaries, especially in the Southwest, in states like California, states like Nevada. And Chuck Rocha is quite a character, just a lot of fun to talk to. But he wrote a book called T.O. Bernie, which will be out and available on August 19th. But he talks a lot about, in his book, his own personal story, which is quite compelling. He kind of grew up, jumped right into the labor movement, and then has been involved in Democratic politics for over 30 years. And he talked about how you build an effective campaign that reaches out to and connects with voters of Hispanic and Latinx descent.
Hey, Pat, you know what T.O. means in Spanish? I know you do.
Yes, it means uncle.
Los. Uncle Bernie.
Uncle Bernie is right. So, folks, I had a lot of fun talking to Chuck Rocha, and I think you'll enjoy listening to the interview as well. And stick around after the interview. We're going to come back for some post-interview. Excited to have you. Could you go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners, who you are and what this new book is about, T.O. Bernie?
Sure, and thank you again for having me on. My name is Chuck Rocha. I grew up in East Texas. I was a senior advisor to Bernie Sanders. It was probably the greatest honor of my life to get to work for Senator Sanders in both the 16 and the 20 election. And, you know, people ask me all the time, what was the hardest thing on the campaign? And I say that it was building out a campaign, putting your blood, sweat, and tears into it, and then being told you had to go home. And then when you went home, you had to shut the campaign down from your house and end the campaign. And you never had a chance to thank all of the supporters, thank all of your staff, hug all your staff and tell them they did a great job. So this book was my outlet to tell the story behind the scenes and put the volunteers and the staff in the room where it happens, as they say in Hamilton, to give them an idea of really what happened behind the scenes with lots of the big moments in the campaign, a real deep dive into the Latino outreach program. And then the first few chapters of the book I thought was important to kind of tell my personal journey to Bernie through lots of life events, being raised by a single mother in East Texas, never going to college, having a criminal record, funny enough, being turned down to work for Hillary in 15 before Bernie ever announced, and a lot of little great stories through my life of wanting to give some ideas to other young black and brown kids out there that may not have a chance to go to Harvard or Yale, and I kind of give them some advice on how I did it, so maybe I could help them do it.
Great. Yeah, so I wanted to ask about that. I saw that you've worked in Democratic politics for some time now, but that you didn't have a college degree. You worked in some pretty labor-intensive jobs. Could you tell us how you got that start in politics? How'd you get started working for campaigns?
It's really a unique story, and I go into great detail in the book, and the book is T.O. Bernie. I talk about being this 19-year-old kid who had just had a kid. I carried on a long tradition of babies having babies in my family. And so I go to my dad, who I'd had like not an estranged relationship, but we had never been really close. He had been divorced from my mom since I was 5. And I ask him to get me a job or help me get me a job at the local factory in Tyler, Texas, where they made Kelly Springfield tires. My dad was a supervisor there. He had moved his way up from being a janitor to there when he had hired into that factory in 1965, I believe. But at that job, at that factory, they had a union. And because they had the union, when I got the job at the factory, because I needed the health care because I just had a baby myself and gotten full custody of this baby when I was 3 months old. So it was very important for me to have health care for this newborn child that I'd taken full custody of and was raising by myself as a single father. So my dad helped me get that job and put in a good word for me. I go to work in this factory. But that story leads to how I got involved in politics, because at this factory, little did I know, is that they had the strongest labor union in East Texas, and some would say in the entire state of Texas. The union there was the United Rubber Workers. The long name was United Rubber, Cork, and Linoleum Workers. I'll never forget that. Local 746 in Tyler, Texas. They would later go on to merge with the steel workers in 95 due to a big strike we were having with Goodyear. But because I got hired at that factory, my dad helped me get that job. I tell this great story in the book about the chief steward coming by and recruiting me to be the local steward on my shift about 7 or 8 months into the job, because my shift steward had bit off to a better job into a better department. My department was really dark. It was hot. It was nasty. It's where we made the rubber. And everybody tried to get out of there as soon as they could because it was just such hard manual labor. And I tell this story, and I'm not going to tell it all here, but there's a great story in there about how activists are born or are activists made. And I go into this story about how by happenstance, I become the union steward because nobody else wanted it. And the union told me they would bring somebody else to do my job if I had to do union work. And so I was like, sign me up. Sounds like I can get paid for not doing my job. So I was all in. And that kind of led and started my career of getting involved in the union, going on to run against that guy who had recruited me and becoming a chief steward, 3 years later at the age of like 23. And then started getting involved in local politics because the local union in my town ran the local Democratic Party. So if you were a young chief steward, you went and you helped put up yard signs back in the early 90s and knock on doors. And so I actually learned politics through the lens of a grassroots organizer, which I think is lost on many mega consultants or chief or big consultants like I am now. They've never had the toils of doing that job and interacting with people. And so I thought my unique look into how politics works was a great way to start this book to give them an idea of the way that I look at politics.
Right. That's great. And I look forward to reading that story. Just so folks know, the book comes out August 19th. Is that right?
It's for pre-sale now at tobernybook.com. You can pre-order there, but the book release date is August the 19th.
Okay, great. So jumping ahead, what was revolutionary about the way Bernie's campaign engaged voters of Latinx heritage?
There's a few reasons that really made it groundbreaking, and people should know that I don't say this lightly, but it was the best and most organized Latino outreach operation in the history of American politics. I don't say that to brag on me. I say that, as my boss would say, Bernie, that I'd brag on us. There were over 200 Latino staffers on the campaign. So I start there. You have to hire people who look like you were trying to organize. So that's A, hire those. You have to have Latinos are the folks you want to organize making the materials, so you need Latino consultants or Latino vendors. That means writing the scripts, making the TV, doing the digital ads, making the phone calls, writing the text scripts, doing the mail, thinking about the newspaper script and the print ads. At every level of all of what that is, which is a multi-layered paid communication structure. We had Latinos at every level, all the way up to me, who was running the campaign day to day with the manager, Faz and Jeff, to implement that, to make sure that there was a layer and a lens of cultural competency throughout every level of this program. So those are just two of like five factors. So we, to recap, it's the staffing. Make sure that they're staffing at every level. Make sure that you have Latinos doing that work, and make sure that there's Latino consultants and vendors creating that work. And then the two other big factors are starting early. Because Latino voters on average are only 27 years old, which is 10 years younger than the average voter, you need to start talking to Latinos earlier than you do everyone else. But start talking to them at the same time you start talking to white voters. There's what I'm going to describe to you is already done in white persuadable universes of people that folks are talking to every day. It's just that folks wait to talk to black people till the very end because they consider them just a GOTV universe. And they wait to talk to Latinos at the very end because they think that they really don't vote at the highest levels they should. So they don't prioritize them till the very end. We turned that on its head and started talking to people very first in all of these states. So 6 or 7 months out, we started talking. And when I mean start talking, if a campaign tells you, oh, we're communicating with Latinos, if they're just putting up a social media post in Spanish, that's not communicating with Latinos. What I mean by that is spending money in our community to talk to us. So that means the first time we spent money sending mail or literature to Latinos in Iowa, it was 7 months before the Iowa caucus. We would go on to talk to that Latino in Iowa 22 times before Election Day, be a piece of mail, a radio commercial, a TV commercial, a digital ad, a newspaper post, a text message, a phone call. All of those things, not some of them, and not in the last minute, but all of them starting very, very early. So early is the key to all of this. And the other piece, last two pieces are, set up your offices in the neighborhood. So if you're going to have field offices, don't make the Latinos drive to the other side of town in the white suburban neighborhood. Set up an office in their neighborhood. And the last and probably the most important, besides the Latino consultant piece, is don't put all your Latinos in some Latino outreach department. Don't have a black outreach department. Don't have a LGBTQ outreach department. What I found over 31 years of doing this work is that we silo off constituents like that. We give them no budget, no authority, and no say-so into seeing the vision of the overall campaign. So they're kind of used as just window dressings when you go to the first Naleo or Unidos candidates for them. Like, look at all of our brown people that work here. And they're just siloed off to have where they're really ineffective. We didn't have a Latino outreach department at the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And again, we ran the most historic outreach in the history of American politics without a Latino department because we interwound or interwoven the Latinos in every department, in leadership in every department. So the Latino outreach program just became part of the overall program.
That sounds very comprehensive. What parts of Bernie's democratic socialist message did you find spoke to Latinx voters the most? Like, what do they find most attractive about Bernie's message?
I will push back, not that you said that it was the most important, but the people who will say that Bernie got all of this vote because the Latino electorate perfectly aligns with his democratic socialist agenda, that's false. And let me explain why. It's partly false because it is partly true. The biggest reason that they voted for Bernie is because we did targeting where we asked Latinos who had never been asked before to join Bernie's revolution. So we went after people, newly registered Latinos, young Latinos, infrequent Latinos who had never really been talked to by anybody else and introduced Bernie to them. And I think that's the biggest reason that they voted for him. But to your point, and let me say this, to your point, after we made the introduction, it was really, really easy to get them on board. And they came on board really, really quick because of the policies and because of his positions at the heart of it around three or four issues. Medicare for All was the most important and the most popular issue amongst the Latino electorate. Second was, believe it or not, what I would call not corruption, but an unfair system. Latinos really didn't like, and keep in mind, many of them come from countries where there's governments that are not open and transparent. So they really got the part about the 1% having all the breaks in the power and the 99%, you know, kind of having to do all the work, but getting none of the repercussions. So they really got this corruption. This corruption message was number two message behind Medicare for All that worked with Latinos. And then three and four right there around each other was the college affordability piece and making community college and state colleges free. That's really a big deal. And then the next was the environment message before immigration. Younger Latinos get this environmental. They like this Green New Deal piece. Most of the time, people don't realize, and a lot of these woke white progressives out there don't realize that Latinos and black people are normally the ones who live in the neighborhoods closest to the pollution because it's the cheapest land. So they get this issue. And as Democrats, sometimes we fail in talking to black and brown people about the environment.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. My students face a lot of those environmental challenges living in some of the poorest neighborhoods of Boston. Mm-hmm. So on the flip side of that, were there moments when Latinx voters were upset or concerned about the socialist label that Bernie uses, the Democratic socialist label, because of negative connotations from, you know, Venezuela or just feelings that they had from their home countries?
Well, let me break that down as a strategist and be very you'll appreciate this. How would I say it if I'm trying to be like a professor? Professorial?
Yeah, sure. Professorial.
Yeah. So we never heard anything about that in the campaign except from reporters.
Okay.
And the reason why is because we ran a different campaign because it was a primary. So we're targeting Democratic primary or likely Democratic primary or newly registered Democratic-leaning voters, right? That's who we're trying to get. We're not out trying to get a conservative Republican Latino who may not like the Democratic socialist tag. So in the primary, we never heard a word from, or it never showed up in any of our polling, any of our focus groups, is that that was a negative connotation of Bernie's position on anything. Now, you would have thought if you sit back and listen to reporters or the news that this was the end of the world, that he was going to be this Democratic socialist and this was going to be why and blah, blah, blah. That's just a false negative for a primary. Now, would this have played more in micro communities like Venezuelans and Cubans in South Florida? Sure. Like I, as a strategist, I know how I would have used that against Bernie Sanders in those areas. But just to be clear, from a pure strategic lens, anybody in South Florida who's Latino, who is already upset about a socialist tag is not going to be too likely to be voting for Democrats as a whole anyway. So I think that your margin of what you would lose and then compared to the margins you would gain by talking about Democratic socialist policies like a $15 minimum wage and a Medicare for All, I think your pluses will be a lot more than your negatives based off of what we saw in this campaign.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. So I often cringe at the way the media covers the Latino demographic as if it's monolithic. You know, it's just like one vote point when that's really far from true. What bothers you about the way the American media or political campaigns talk about Latinx families and how they're represented in the media? Like, what is it? What gets you going when you hear it said over and over?
You are literally trying to upset me on this thing. So it's just the bane of my existence. Like it's. Again, I'm the most senior Democratic strategist in Washington, D.C. I've been doing this for 31 years. I'm literally sitting in my house. I'm so blessed to have a single family home here in Southeast D.C. on the backside of the Capitol. And I'm surrounded by consultants who think they know everything. I'm surrounded by consultants who went to Harvard and Yale and whose mom and daddy are somebody and this whole woke white class of people who are going to save all of us black and brown folks. And I say that because I've just been sitting in the room so often when I've seen the mistakes happen, right? And I go through this in the book, the T.O. Bernie book, about, you know, my own insecurities as a young man, not going to college, learning campaigns by knocking on doors and putting up yard signs and doing the brass tacks parts of just the grassroots organizing of figuring out the right time to challenge this authority. And I write about this, trying to give hope to young black and brown staffers or young poor white staffers who just may not have any inroads into that elite class to say there are times when you have to, you know, speak up. And I use the example when I'm pitching my firm, and my firm is called Solidarity Strategies. We're the largest Latino owned and operated firm in the country. We've been operating for 10 years. I don't tell you that to try to sell you something from the firm. I tell you that because I'm most proud of, in 10 years, we've had over 100 young black and brown kids come through the firm as associates who've mentored under me and my team and then have went off to do amazing things. I think that's what's going to start making changes. And making changes to a system, to your point and your question of the mistakes. I tell people that my son is named Charles Rocha. My given name on the voter file is Charles Rocha. I live in Washington, D.C., single family home. I come home every afternoon. I'll fix me a glass of tea or a glass of bourbon, all depending on how my day was. I'll turn on a 72-inch TV. I will start back to work. I'll peruse Facebook. I'll watch MSNBC and go back and forth between that and a baseball game normally. And that's where I'm consuming information. My son is 29 years old, lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has two kids of his own, carrying on a long tradition again of having babies when you're a baby. And he is a union apprentice at the Plumbers Union. He comes home. He don't even own a TV. The boys watch their cartoons on a laptop. He consumes everything through different social media outlets than I do. And he couldn't be more different on how he looks at the world. But on the voter file, we're both Latino. We're both Charles Rocha. And that media consultant or that consultant who's running that campaign, normally it's 99% of the time, it's the media consultant, will say if we're going to do Latino outreach, we take our best English ad that we think is the greatest English ad ever. We add Spanish subtitles to it or Google translate it into Spanish and we run it on Univision. And that is our Latino outreach program. Maybe the last 2 weeks we hire a bunch of brown kids to go door to door in the Latino community. But that is how Latino outreach has been done in all of the campaigns for most of my life. And if you do that, you've missed old man Charles Rocha and young man Charles Rocha, who neither one are watching Spanish language Univision ads.
Right. And you're also missing the whole cultural context. You know, you're just taking an ad in English and just flipping it right to Spanish, right?
To your point, like, let's think about this. So that same Charles Rocha in Miami, who's Cuban, the same Charles Gonzalez in San Antonio, the same Rafael Navarre in East Los Angeles, and the Dominican in New York, all of those people are Latino on the voter file, and they all culturally are just so different, not just the way they speak Spanish, but lots of nuances in their own culture that will make you step on a landmine if you say the word the wrong way, if you put the wrong imagery in there, you know, when you start talking about Puerto Ricans and them not being, like, all these things about the island and the respect and the music, like, that's where you really step on landmines.
Right. So moving on again to Biden here. Do you think the Biden team gets it like the Bernie team did? And what could they do aside from hiring you to make them get it a little better?
Well, they're getting it better because they didn't have any money in the beginning. And they have started hiring some senior staff over there. And that's encouraged me. And they needed to start spending their money early. They need to buy my book, T.O. Bernie, next week when it comes out on the 19th. And just read what it does and just do it. Spend money, spend it on these communications, layer it in this way, hire these kind of consultants, and it just lays out how to do it state by state. The reason that worries me is that the only reason the Bernie campaign got to do what it did is I was in a position of budget authority. Like, I could protect the Latino budget that's always cut in every campaign. There's not a Latino with Biden campaign that's in the room that's really high up. They have some amazing senior advisors over there. Cristobal is great. Julie is great. Jason is great. Like, they're my friends. Like, we barbecue when there's not a campaign going on in D.C. Like, these are truly like my friends. But are they really in the room and can really tell Joe Biden we need to spend $10 million on the Latino outreach? I hope so. I like to think that they are. I know for a fact they're fighting to. Now, whether the three white consultants that are running that thing listens to them is what I worry about.
Right. That makes sense. And so lastly, I read an op-ed in the Times just after it seemed pretty inevitable that Biden would be the nominee. And it made a pretty interesting point in that COVID was kind of a huge factor in making Biden the presumptive nominee, and that people were a little more likely to go with what they considered to be a safer candidate because of the looming pandemic. Do you put any stock in that? What do you think, you know, was the biggest factor in that complete 180 turn where, you know, Bernie was the front runner and then all of a sudden we had that swing to Biden?
I talk about this in the book. I know exactly what happened because I was there, and it's like a bad nightmare. As we came out of Nevada, we had polling. We had lots of polling. We had run polls in every one of the Super Tuesday states. And with Mike Bloomberg getting into the race and spending real money, what that had done was position Bernie in a position in, I'm telling you this, and this is a fact. This is not something on Twitter you read from somebody. I read these polls, and they were decent polls because we made them be fair. You don't want your pollster to lie to you. I will say to your on your show today that we were winning every Super Tuesday state in America, every single one the day after Nevada. That means we were even winning Florida by 2 points the day after. So what happens there is this, is you know as well as I know that we're not the only one who has this exact same polling if you're running in other races. So everybody after we had just whooped their butt in Nevada and proved that we had figured out the Latinos, and here we go into South Carolina, we're fixing to be the nominee. We're literally fixing to walk away with this thing. And the Democratic Party, I can't prove this, but you can see that there was a phone call going out, a bat signal that was raised, and somebody somewhere was like, yo, 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 Bernie Sanders is fixing to be the nominee if we don't do something. So you saw everybody drop out after they saw that polling. Everybody coalesce behind Biden, and we just could not beat Biden in a one-on-one without a few more people in the race and without Michael Bloomberg spending some more money in the Super Tuesday states. And so that was just it, the consolidation, because presidential campaigns are not about strategy at that point when you get that far. It's just about momentum. Your people who are listening to this are like, Chuck, that makes no sense. Let me prove your point. Joe Biden won states where he had not spent a dollar. Joe Biden won states where he did not have one single staffer on Super Tuesday, but just because of momentum, to your point, where people were like, if everybody else is out, we got to go with the safe alternative. Plus this Corona thing is happening. And like, can Bernie Sanders, who we kind of like, but can he really win the general? Like, all this doubt got in. Like, we were just 3 days from being the nominee.
Right. That brings back some flashbacks for me right there.
It makes just a lot of pain over here on my end of the phone. There's a lot, my eyes twitching because we were that close to making a dream come true for Senator Sanders, which is all I really wanted to do.
Well, with each announcement of someone dropping out, I was just texting my wife, who were like, no way. You know, it did seem like it was organized at some level there. So let's give one last plug of your book here before we close. So your book comes out the 19th. Where do people go to pre-order it?
You can go to T-O, that's T-I-O. TOBurnieBook.com. TOBurnieBook.com is a website we created that's got some amazing art that you can see the cover. I'm really proud of the cover of this book. Looks like no other book. There's custom art on this book by a famous Pulitzer-nominated and now Emmy Award-winning Mexican artist who literally lives in East LA named Lalo Alcarez, who drew a picture of me and Bernie and AOC on the front with lots of my family members and friends in the crowd. And so the art itself is worth the $19 of the book. And then there's a lot of great blurbs from my friends. But go there. You can order it from lots of different places. But you only have to go to that one website to buy it, TOBurnieBook.com.
That sounds fantastic. I'll do that. And I hope my listeners do as well. Mr. Rocha, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And take care of yourself.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back, folks. So, Carlos, what was your takeaways from how Chuck decided to run the campaign in 2020?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, for the listeners who haven't been introduced to me yet, I'm Latino, right? I found it incredibly interesting. Like the level of detail that Chuck went into how the campaigns were structured, right? How this campaign was structured to focus on the Latinx vote. He clearly understood you can't treat Latinos as a monolith, right? There are many different cultures in the Latino cultures, and you know, I found that incredibly interesting. I actually learned a lot about not just, you know, how to run a campaign or a messaging campaign and get voters engaged, but also how to specifically target a certain demographic and how to, you know, segment that demographic to best tailor the message. I found that incredibly interesting.
Well, it sounds like it was really driven by Latinos too.
Right, absolutely. From the ground up, he had Latinos in every part of that campaign. And I think what really struck me is that in the room where the major decisions were being made, he had members of that Latino outreach program. So he said that there wasn't basically a separate Latino outreach program. They were completely intertwined with the campaign itself.
Absolutely. One thing that kind of is still, you know, ringing in my head is when he talked about, you know, the me as Chuck Senior and his son is, you know, Chuck Rocha Junior, and he said, you know, he was kind of poking fun at how, you know, campaigns in the past have been sort of trying to target the Latino community by putting ads on Univision, and I found that interesting because I don't watch Univision, right? I don't tend to watch it. My mom still does, you know, if there were going to be any ads, you know, it's trying to target, I guess, me, just like Chuck Senior and Chuck Junior, they would miss me, right? And so they wouldn't capture me, right? I found that incredibly interesting.
Pat, it seems like he's a super compelling speaker and activist. Like, what was it like to interview him?
Yeah, he was really engaging, just really entertaining to be on the call with. He kind of carried, there was just a lot of energy to him. And he was really honest. So I kind of, at the end, I laid up that question for him with, you know, mentioning the op-ed from the Times that kind of suggested that the pandemic had chosen Biden as the nominee, as the safe choice. And he didn't really take the bait on that. He just went straight for it and said, you know, that he can't prove it, but he feels like there was some type of bat signal sent out for every other candidate who wasn't Biden to drop out, so that Biden would take all those votes and kind of charge ahead with the nomination.
Yeah, the party definitely consolidated. If you just look at it from a bird's eye view and you see how fast it sort of happened, right? You know, after the pandemic really kind of set in, and some of these key battleground states, the votes were kind of coming out. You know, the thing just kind of precipitated, and it happened so fast. You can definitely make that case.
I will say, though, I've been hardcore Bernie for at least a decade, because I grew up in Vermont, and I will say that I absolutely wanted Bernie to win. But imagine if this had been strung out with the pandemic and they went, let's say, till the end of June, I think the Republicans and Trump would have been able to focus more on that wedge between them. Whereas now, like, Trump's failures on coronavirus and racial reconciliation are so bear because Biden is just like trying to keep his mouth shut and just let Trump run all over himself. Don't you feel like if they still had those two battling it out, that would be worse for the ultimate election of the candidate?
I don't think that's a bad point at all. I think that's really fair. But I will say that I'm still frustrated with Biden's, you know, lack of willingness to take on this pandemic as inspiration and as a cause for full support for Medicare for All. You know, you've got rates that are in the high 80% for Democrats, registered Democrats who support working towards Medicare for All. And Biden's still unwilling to say that he's going to push for that policy. So from that one, you know, standpoint, and Chuck Rocha said that with the Latino community, their number one issue was Medicare for All. And I think we're really missing out on an opportunity here. But you're right, Dan. I do think that continued division within the party would have really looked kind of bad. And it wouldn't have given us the opportunity to paint Trump as the failure that he is as we're approaching November 3rd. But I would like to invite all of our listeners to go ahead and rate us and like us on whichever podcast platform you use to listen to us. We want to, if you have a chance to review us, please do that. That is how people find out about podcasts. And until next time, folks, thanks for hanging out with us.
Thanks, people. See you next time.
Peace.
Peace out.